Welcome to MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me is James. Is James? As James. Check out our website, themacguffinman.com. We most recently talked about Jason Bourne. Before that was A Mighty Wind, and the Mulholland Drive and Gattaca before that. You can follow us on Twitter at the MacGuffin Man, and tell your friends and tell your enemies.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. And now, here are Alex and James.
James.
Yeah, Alex.
Let's get schneef to the dome and talk about a movie.
After doing the big, blustery Jason Bourne, it's nice to quiet down and do something a little subtler,
yeah,
a bit more internal.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we're talking about Scarface.
Scarface, the 1983 version.
Oh, yeah.
That's right. All you Paul Mooney fans out there can fuck off for another week.
Keep holding your breath.
Yeah, exactly.
George Raft heads out there. Yeah, I mean, it's this Scarface got so big that a lot of people really kind of forgot that it's a remake, eh?
Oh, 100%.
Despite the first one being extremely well regarded, mm-hmm, and even kind of a big media story in its day for its realistic depictions of violence and things like that, this one is just so culturally huge that it's kind of disappearing from the radar.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, has basically disappeared from the radar outside of film nerds such as yourself and I, and Martin Scorsese probably loves it too and could talk about it at length, but yeah, it really has. It has eliminated the one that inspired it entirely. And I think part of that is maybe the original Scarface would have had longer legs if it was a more, I don't know, a star that has lasted more, like a Cary Grant sort of thing, where people can still reference him pretty frequently and most people understand who they're talking about. And that's something that the 1983 version has going for it still today, is that everybody knows who Al Pacino is and he is the lead of this movie. And it's a very Pacino-y performance. Like, this is a real transition performance for Pacino, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you can't call it one of his all-time great performances.
But you also can't not call it that.
Yeah, I know. It's impossible. And I was just thinking about this movie, and obviously, inevitably, Al Pacino's career trajectory, as you were kind of touching on there. Mm-hmm. And I think about his Sonny Corleone and how
Michael.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, yeah. Michael.
Yeah.
And how it's such an impressive performance because of how quiet and subtle it is. And you can kind of see him mulling these things over so quietly and the internal struggle. Mm-hmm. And then there's this, you know, a decade later, which is almost the exact opposite.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, there are spaces in between 1970 or films in between 1974 and 1983 where we sort of get Pacino getting bigger while still exhibiting that restraint. Like, Injustice for All is a really good middle point between Scarface and Godfather 2. And he's really, really good in Injustice for All. That's I think, pretty underrated movie. But yeah, and there's a lot going on in his life in between these two performances as well, in that he was still a functional alcoholic on the sets of The Godfather 2, which ended up turning into a non-functioning alcoholic, and he quit drinking in 1978, I think. So there's now just like, that's such a big life change for somebody that relies on alcohol to then having no alcohol at all and has to figure out how to live their life again. Maybe he just couldn't deal with being that restrained, quiet, like keeping all of Michael inside, you know, couldn't keep, yeah, all of Tony inside, you know. And that also, The Godfather is just a quieter film than Scarface. Like, Scarface was meant to be loud, and Tony Montana was similarly meant to be loud the whole time, you know.
Yeah, I mean, everything about this movie is excess.
Yes.
Right, I mean, from the bright pinks to the score to the length to the performance of Tony,
yeah,
and you know, thematically, this movie is clearly all about just overdoing something until it can't possibly remain any longer.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it was just researching it for this one, I realized that this was Al Pacino's idea.
Yeah, yeah. He saw the original, as you know, as people used to do in the 70s before home video was a thing that existed. He just happened to be seeing a repertory screening of Scarface and thought it was really great and really loved specifically Paul Mooney's performance. And he eventually called Martin Bregman, who used to be his manager, turned into a producer, and they had become estranged. But he eventually called Bregman and was like, "We should remake this movie. It's got a real life to it, and I feel like we can do something cool with it."
Yeah,
probably not Pacino's exact words, but you know what I mean.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, and then Sidney Lumet was almost involved and, well, I guess was for a point and had some creative differences.
Yeah, exactly. He was involved and apparently suggested the whole Cuban immigrant. I forget what the Mariel thing. Yeah. What's that called?
The Mariel boat lift is what it's known as commonly.
He suggested that as sort of the backbone for the plot. And that must have come after they figured out it was financially unfeasible to do a straight remake of the 1930s version, which would have had to take place in Chicago, and period pieces are notoriously expensive to pull off.
A bunch of cars from the 1920s.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so Sidney Lumet had suggested that and eventually ended up leaving the film. And Brian De Palma left Flashdance to join this film. And which is really interesting. I love imagining the version of Flashdance as directed by Brian De Palma. Oh, but
both of those hypotheticals are interesting.
Yeah.
Me.
Oh, for sure. I agree entirely. And it's interesting.
I think I know which one I'd like more, but they're both fun to think about.
Yeah. But it's interesting because Brian De Palma was initially attached to The Prince of the City, which is a Sidney Lumet movie from 1980 that he then got fired from and Sidney Lumet took over because they found out they could get Sidney Lumet and thought it would be better than Brian De Palma, but I thought that was kind of interesting. But yeah, Sidney Lumet was involved in this movie early on, and partially due to his connection to Al Pacino via Serpico and Dog Day Afternoon, but he ended up leaving the project.
Yeah, it's my understanding that it was more about the kind of the Cuban politics, as you said, but also about the American politics and how federal drug policy and things and immigration and things on the American side kind of facilitated what was a pretty nasty scene in Florida in the 80s.
Yeah, for sure. And that stuff is still hinted at in the film, but that's about it.
Oh yeah, I don't see much of it. I mean, we get the on-screen text explaining it. we get the video of Castro a little bit.
Yeah.
But not much else. I mean, we have a corrupt FBI.
Or yeah, it's
narcotics division.
Yeah, blanket statement or blanket person in place of law enforcement. Harris Yulin, I think that's how he's credited.
Yeah, very chill performance from him as people are being murdered in front of him. Is what struck me about his performance this time around.
Right before his last line, his right before he gets shot, when he yells "fuck you," that's an all time great "fuck you." Though. Like the way he yells it is great.
In a movie of 226 fuck you.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, 226 F-bombs.
Yeah, but exactly.
I think a lot of those are wrapped up in fuck yous. It's the casual fuck yous that go back and forth between seemingly friends at times that
it's
get me the most about the profanity in this one.
Yeah.
So what made you want to come around to finally doing Scarface?
I mean, I just always want to talk about Brian De Palma movies. And the problem with talking about Brian De Palma is that my favorite Brian De Palma movies fall into that category of, like, even for our podcast, nobody would listen to it. You know, like, if we did a podcast on Snake Eyes, which I have hours of theories about, like, it would be a good podcast that would be, like, shouted into a canyon of nothingness, you know.
I was reading Roger Ebert's great movies review about this movie.
Uh-huh.
And he was crediting De Palma and said even his bad movies or even his failures are interesting. Snake Eyes was at least ambitious.
And it's so ambitious. The movie's so ambitious. I swear, if anybody ever writes a book about Snake Eyes, it will be me, and nobody will read it, but the book might exist one day. Anyway, but yeah, and that's kind of the core of Brian De Palma's career, is that he has made a lot of movies that aren't, like, good, or aren't, you know, certainly aren't worth talking about to the length that we typically talk about movies. But he's so talented that I just always want to talk about his skill, you know, just because I find him really fascinating. And he also, almost without exception, makes really entertaining movies, even when his movies are terrible. Like, I watched Black Dahlia, his 2006 film about the Black Dahlia, a couple weeks ago, and it was so bad. But it was so well made, and that's the thing about his movies, is that even when he makes a bad movie, he makes it so well that it's really fun to watch. And he typically makes these genre pictures that I just generally have a pretty strong attachment to in general, you know.
Yeah, and I know we must have talked about this on our Carrie podcast. I mean, he's got his early horror stuff and some, you know, later stuff that involves violence and gore, no doubt. Mm-hmm. But he's capable of making very different kinds of movies.
Yeah, absolutely. And he does always sort of, he finds a way to make totally different situations similarly interesting. Like the climactic sequence from Carrie, the lead up to that is interesting in the way the lead up to the chainsaw scene is in Scarface, even though they're totally different scenarios. And I mean, you're both doing, in each case, you're doing, build up to an action sequence, but totally different kinds of action sequences, you know?
Yeah, that chainsaw scene might be my favorite part of this movie.
Oh, from a filmmaking perspective, 100%.
So how does he achieve that? Why would we both kind of stick to that as something that, you know, it's not a huge action scene. I mean, there are only really a few in this movie, mm-hmm. one particular notable one. Speaking of excess,
yeah, exactly.
But how do you think that that's achieved here?
Well, it's all it's all in the buildup, I find, you know, because when you think about action sequences that you really enjoy, typically a lot of the enjoyment comes before the action even really starts, and just the way that the scene is established and the scene is sort of set up. I mean, we've talked about this ad nauseum on this podcast about how important geography is to action sequences. Like, when you understand where everybody is, it allows you to know more of what's going on. And also, when something does surprise you, like, it makes it more surprising, you know, just because you're like, oh, I thought he was down in the car or wherever, you know? And, there is just a real slow tension building in that sequence from their meeting where they're, saying their names to each other, to them talking about how they don't have the coke, they don't have the money, all that stuff. And then we've got Manny down in the car, being very irresponsible. And
Idiot girl, so unlike him.
Yeah, so unlike Manny. yeah, and just also the way that the camera, there's a couple specific moments in that scene as things are actually starting to ratchet up. Like, once the guy brings Angel into the shower and the camera goes away from that scene and into the blinds, and then we get a cut to outside of the blinds, and then that cranes down to show us that Manny's not paying attention to what's happening, and then we go back up into the bathroom window where the chainsaw sequence actually happens. So, like, it gives you that time, because these are not shots that happen quickly. It gives you that time to think about, holy shit, what is that going to happen with this chainsaw, you know? Because, yeah, like, that happens right as the chainsaw comes out. You get taken out of the room. So then you have to think about, because it's the most terrifying aspect of the scene, like, what is going to happen with that chainsaw? And when you get back in, you find out nothing yet has happened, but something's about to, and it sort of ratchets up how horrifying that sequence is.
Yeah, I really like how slowly the camera drifts to the car and back, too.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And then you're just spending all this time, as you said, wondering what's going to happen, and the juxtaposition of how intense and, you know, we assume about to be horrific scene in the bathroom compared to the very, very relaxing outdoors.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, really, really builds that up.
Yeah, exactly. And I think another thing that this sequence is representative of as far as Brian De Palma's skills throughout his career is that the action part of it is way shorter than the buildup. And I think that's a really a notable thing that people tend to forget when they're trying to figure out how to make a good action sequence. A lot of times movies will just be like, oh, if the action sequence is longer, people will be more invested. And that's not really the case, because by having fewer things happen in the actual action portion of things, it magnifies those actions and makes them more interesting. It sort of gives you a stronger impact, I find.
Yeah, and I think we can see the point of diminishing returns crossed over in the final shootout, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, yes. Yeah. I think there's a there are a variety of takes to be had on that sequence, but
yeah, I mean, again, just to point to the theme of excess that underscores this entire movie. You know, in the shower, we have that an action sequence that's mostly build up and a bit of action. I mean, people are definitely shot and chainsawed. I mean, it's not as though nothing happens, but the ratio of build up to payoff in that scene is so rewarding, and then it's very much reversed by the end. I mean, I forgot how much of this, you know, final, I don't know, 25 minutes of this movie is almost real time. I mean, we edit out some of the driving from one house to the next, but
that's about it.
Yeah, I mean, we have Manny's house, we have him in the mansion, and then that whole shootout is, you know, it's not one shot or anything, but it'd be pretty much real time.
Yeah. And it's there's a weird, like the first 45 minutes to an hour of this movie moves so quickly, and then the middle slows down, and then the last 25 minutes is so fast paced. Like it's a real odd movie, I find.
Yeah.
Some real ebbs, some real flows.
Yes. Yeah. How much do you actually like sitting through this movie? I mean, is it all kind of good filmmaking and a certain kind of Pacino appreciation?
Well, I mean, this is even, like, as far as Brian De Palma goes, this is pretty middle of the pack. Like, that's kind of the only real set piece that he's got in it. And there's some good stuff. I think the first shot of the movie that's not archival footage is really great. And I think representative of how I feel about this movie as a whole. Do you remember
the shot?
It's when Tony is just sitting in the immigration office and he's being interrogated more or less about coming to America, and the camera's just, it's in a one take until somebody grabs his hand and looks at his tattoo, and the camera is sort of circling around Tony, and his is the only face that we can see in the frame. It's just bodies around him, and Pacino is just so entertaining in that movie. And that's kind of how I feel about this movie, is that, like, I just watch Pacino and everything is okay, because I just find him so entertaining in this movie. Like, even over the top Pacino, like, I do still love. And this is, like, the best version of over the top Pacino, I think. It sort of shows how I feel about the movie, that it should just be a camera focused on Al Pacino the whole time, you know, and that's how the best way to enjoy this movie.
Yeah,
just accept that Al Pacino is going full Pacino and just drink it in.
The part that might have given me the biggest laugh, even though it's definitely not the biggest Pacino, is when he's out buying the car with Elvira.
Mm-hmm.
He says $43,000. Is that all? And kind of looks at her and has a little beat there, and it's just, he's just so transparent and such a piece of shit.
Yeah.
Something about that part of, you know, he's very authentic in a lot of ways. I mean, he certainly doesn't just run his mouth and back it up with nothing. He certainly does run his mouth, but he does everything to back it up. Just that part of him putting on a show and the bravado, I think, when he's not being as cool, I thought was some of my favorite stuff to watch of his.
Yeah, for sure. And I think shortly after that, you get the goofy Pacino, which doesn't come out a lot in this movie, when he's got the hat on in the car.
Yeah.
Which is great. Love me some goofy Pacino. But, like, he does do some really impressive things throughout this movie, obviously because he's Al Pacino and he's one of the best actors ever. But, like, in that sequence that I talked about, like, he's got so many lines and he delivers them all in such an engaging way. And the bad guy scene is great. I'm sure we'll talk about that. Also done in a long take. And then there's another really small moment when he's at Sosa's Sosa's complex, I guess we could call it. House doesn't seem to do it justice.
Not villa?
Yeah. It's a small country. And him and F. Murray Abraham have been brought bowls of like hot water with lemon in them. And while Sosa goes to take a call, and Tony or Al Pacino starts eating the lemon, not realizing that he's supposed to like dip his fingers into it. And that, like, it's all just something that happens it's not focused on close ups or anything, but it's such a nice little touch. That's like, yeah, this guy is in above his head socially right now. And I just thought that was a really small, nice moment that I'd never noticed before.
Yes. I did notice that as well.
It's great.
Yeah.
And he's just like, yeah, I'm going to eat the fucking lemon. That's what you do. It's in a bowl of water. Dessert.
The hanging someone out of a helicopter is a pretty dope move.
I can't believe, I guess because this movie eventually became popular enough, I can't believe it hasn't happened more. Like, it's just, as far as ways for a gangster to kill somebody, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, because he dies without the rope.
Yeah, exactly.
But you hang him anyway.
Yeah, for sure.
But then you don't have to clean up your villa as much after.
Yeah, so. Your compound.
Very convenient.
Yeah, exactly.
I like Sosa a lot too, actually.
Sosa's great. The guy playing Sosa is really good in this movie.
Yeah, I kind of forgot about him because, again, there's just so much happening in this movie. Yeah. And to think about anyone who's not Al Pacino can be hard when this is what he's doing with his screen time. But yeah. I thought his performance is very nice and just understated and well done.
Yeah, and he's got a real theatrical voice too, which I think fits in with this movie really well. Like a really strong theatrical voice, you know? Like, yeah. You can tell that guy spent some time on the stage.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. What about Michelle Pfeiffer?
I mean, I don't really have any thoughts, I guess. I don't know. I feel bad about the way her character's treated, but she also doesn't seem to be a good person. But she may have been a good person before the drugs. I don't know. I feel like on all questions related to women in this movie, I will probably just abstain.
Okay. Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah,
I don't think a lot of thought was put into their plight either.
No,
so.
No.
I think that's fair.
Yeah. De Palma and Oliver Stone, the writer of this movie. I don't know if you mentioned that.
Oh, but, no, he didn't.
Yeah. Both are not exactly noted feminists. You know, so.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, is it often forgotten that Oliver Stone was involved in this? I rarely hear his name mentioned when people talk about this movie.
I kind of find the opposite. I feel like people feel like it's more of an Oliver Stone movie than a Brian De Palma movie. Like, at least in the way that people have talked about it with me, I just find that maybe this is me thinking about 10 years ago when I would talk about this movie with people, you know, when I worked at a video store. But people just sort of viewed it as more of an Oliver Stone movie, just in the way that Platoon came out in 1986, a few years after this.
And 87.
So, sorry?
87.
Was it 87? Okay. So that was a big cultural thing. Did it win Best Picture?
I think so.
Yeah, I think it did, which is unfortunate. But
Platoon's good.
Okay, great.
I'll put a pin in this. And then we'll talk about Untouchables.
Oliver Stone should have put a pin in Platoon. I think his rise to prominence in the time before Scarface became famous, like by the time culture had sort of really drank in Scarface, it had become more of an Oliver Stone movie than a Brian De Palma movie. And apparently Oliver Stone was really hands-on in the production of the movie, to the point that Brian De Palma kicked him off the set for talking to the actress too much. So I don't know. I think it is a real, it's not, you know, Sorkin and Fincher doing the Social Network, because they by all accounts work together really well. But it's something like that, where they were both prominent voices to the point where the one with the slightly more prominent voice got to kick the other off the set.
Yeah, I think, I mean, this might upset you, but I think for mainstream audiences, Brian De Palma's name doesn't really stick like Oliver Stone's does.
No, I agree 100%. That was kind of what I was trying to say,
yeah,
in way more words and way less clear. But you know what I mean.
Yep.
That's why you're here, to translate my my garbage.
I'm so happy to be here.
But yeah, I agree 100%. Like, if Brian De Palma put out a movie on the same day that Snowden came out, Oliver Stone's name would still be talked about more. Yeah.
I find the only, I mentioned a little while ago that Tony Montana always lives up to his word and isn't, you know, just all talk. I'm disappointed. I find he didn't really carve up his assassination target the way he kind of promised he would, eh?
Yeah, he really does just stab Rubango once, basically. Or I guess once or twice. It's a pretty pretty normal stabbing.
Yeah, and he says, for a green card, I'll carve him up good. And
yeah.
I mean, that couldn't have been shorter. I mean, I guess he says something to him, too.
I mean, the terror that the group in, makes him feel before he dies, I think that's prominent. Maybe it's a De Palma situation where he spent all his time on the build-up and not a lot on the actual action.
It's and, early Scarface De Palma, not late Scarface De Palma.
Exactly. And also, I mean, you gotta look at it, Tony's still an amateur at that point. He hasn't even seen chainsaws in action sequences yet, so he doesn't even know that's a possibility.
That's true. That's yeah. true.
Because Angel gets carved up.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very bloody. I mean, there's some debate over whether or how important that scene was to the initial X rating this movie got. Did you want to talk about that ratings process? Are you familiar with that?
The only thing, like, in general, my feeling about talking about ratings process is that, like, the whole thing is so fickle and poorly regulated that it's almost pointless to talk about it, because it's just, like, sometimes one dude is just offended by this one thing and they're just like, nope, this is a sticking point, rated X, you know, like,
yeah.
And I don't know, it just seems weird to me. And also, Scarface doesn't seem like, as somebody that grew up watching movies, primarily started watching movies in the 90s, it doesn't seem that violent to me. So it, like, just seems weird that this is a movie that would get an X rating. But also, I mean, it being released sort of allows a new type of violence to be considered rated R as well. So I was kind of desensitized before I could really have an opinion on it. But
it's tough to look at it on the continuum of...
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it's... In reading about this again, I mentioned this before, but the original Scarface kind of set a precedent about what people can get away with violence-wise.
Yeah.
And I think part of their concern with that one as well was... that it was loosely based on Al Capone's life, mm-hmm. but mimicked a lot of events that people, you know, had been reading about in the news not that much earlier. Mm-hmm. And so to kind of use a real person's death to make entertainment or to make money, I think offended some people. This one, it's the violence and the language, I understand. I mean, there had been F-bombs in movies before, but it was just the amount, the degree to which it's used, and very clear, constant drug use. These are just a few things that had all been shown before, but hadn't been shown to this degree or, you know, with this clarity or with this amount of repetition.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess the thing that I'm confused by is that, like, by all accounts, what I've read is that the problem for the MPAA was the number of times the clown gets shot, which is just so weird to me.
Yeah. The part of this movie people would forget.
Yeah, exactly.
For good reason, too. Yeah. It's so weird.
It's very weird. Even weirder, Richard Belzer is a comedian, or as the comedian, I guess.
I love the bells so much.
Yeah, it's pretty great. But yeah, that's kind of my whole, like, anytime you hear about a struggle with the MPAA, it's something like how many times the clown gets shot, you know? The thing I do find enjoyable is that in their appeal process to the MPAA, De Palma and Pacino, and apparently Roger Ebert spoke, and...
yeah. I think narcotics officer from Miami, or at least Florida.
Yeah.
Just trying to say... This is what happens. I mean,
yeah,
this is real. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. So after, because I think De Palma had made three cuts to try and appease them, and then they eventually they appealed the X rating. And after this appeal, with all these people speaking, they did get their R rating for the third cut. And Brian De Palma just figured he could still, they wouldn't notice the differences between the third and the first cut. So he released the first cut and nobody noticed.
I think that's awesome.
That's great.
Yeah, that's fantastic. That's my favorite part of the story.
The good part of the story.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about the hip hop connection?
Sure. I mean, I think I saw this movie because I listened to a lot of rap music and heard it mentioned so many times. Well, actually, I know that's true. I think actually a lot of my movie tastes are built on the fact that Redman had a really good taste in the 90s as far as film goes.
He watched a lot of Kung Fu.
No, Redman wasn't in with the Wu-Tang, the film choices. He was just a very... he had really good taste in action movies, basically. Like, he's had some really deep cut references to The Usual Suspects in his lyrics, and I don't know. Redman's got
most rap lyrics seem to be a bit of horror movies, Scarface, a couple other action movies. I don't know about The Usual Suspects. That's pretty fantastic.
Yeah. And I think he also dropped a real deep cut The Negotiator reference at one point, which I thought was really funny, but I don't remember the line. But anyway, so Scarface has become a very prominent film in hip hop and in hip hop culture, especially for rappers that became popular in the 90s and early 2000s. It feels like it has kind of been phased out of the music just by rappers of a certain age aging out of that group. But yeah, and I think you can pretty easily see it. It's somebody that that really doesn't have a lot and is able to achieve an aspect of the American dream, even if that American dream ends up killing him. And that's where a lot of the first really popular rappers came from. And there's a lot of poverty in the backgrounds of Nas and Jay-Z and all of these golden age rappers, you know? And so you can really see where it comes from. Yeah.
Yeah, no, 100%. And I think being a minority who speaks and acts differently than people around you, I think might give them more to relate to as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I mean, just in general, again, drug culture is a very big part for a lot of rappers as well. I mean, excuse me, Biggie and Jay-Z are a really good example of this. Like, Biggie has a song called The Ten Crack Commandments, and one of the commandments is a line from Scarface, which is don't get high on your own supply. So, like, rap sort of turned Scarface into its Bible, basically, because it's a commandment and all that stuff. And Jay-Z's album, Reasonable Doubt, has a lot of prominent Scarface references to my recollection. And there was a guy called Pain in the Ass that would do a good Pacino impression that rappers, New York rappers, would hire to have on their albums, just impersonating Pacino.
That's
it's
awesome.
Really great. Yeah. And I mean, it became so prominent that on the 20th anniversary of this movie, there was a like new soundtrack released for Scarface, which was all of these rap songs that had been influenced by Scarface. Like, I think Raekwon's Criminology is on it, because it's got the phone confrontation with Sosa at the beginning of it. There's a Mobb Deep track that samples Giorgio Moroder's score. It's just really, it's like thinking about that having been a thing, you know, 13 years ago, especially with where the music industry is now, is just so baffling to me. Like, that was an official release that people were like, yeah, we should get all the clearances for this. This will make us money. Like, it's just so crazy, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, I could also, at the time, I could totally see why they were doing it. I was like, of course this makes sense. If you're a capitalist, you're going to make money here.
Yeah, you watched enough episodes of Scrubs to know that, of Cribs, to know that every rapper had a very prominently featured Scarface something.
Yeah, exactly. There's on that 20th anniversary, they also put out a new DVD release of the movie with a documentary. It was like funded by Def Jam and directed by Benny Boom, a prominent music video director, hip hop music video director mostly. And it's just rappers talking about how much they love Scarface. And there's a like Trick Daddy's interview happens with on his, he's on his bed with the Scarface blinds behind him, a Scarface poster on the wall next to him. It's so funny. And the people that they get to talk about it, like it's so wide ranging. Puff Daddy claims that, or Diddy, I suppose by that time, claims he's seen it 63 times, which is such a weird number to remember.
And Snoop watches it every month, he claims.
Oh, yeah. Okay. But yeah, there's a lot of really interesting stuff in that. And certainly in 2003, I was very interested in watching a crossover between my two favorite things, hip hop and action movies at the time, you know?
Yeah. And wasn't De Palma approached about having the soundtrack like entirely redone within the film?
Yeah, I have heard about that. Mostly through like the internet versions of hearsay. So like, but I mean, that's also the same about how we feel about rumors, film rumors, Hollywood rumors that are way older. It's just not the internet version of hearsay, but yeah. And I totally understand why he would not agree to do that.
Yeah.
Also Brian De Palma, he doesn't strike me as a huge Nas fan, you know?
Yeah. And it's not as though only people in hip hop like this movie and, everyone else is done talking about it and it's going to slip out of culture anytime soon. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is still kind of a very present movie in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Yeah. It certainly feels less so now, but definitely 13 years ago when they were doing this re-release, it still felt very present in culture.
Okay.
Yeah. And a part of the reason it feels less present is just because everything old is less present, just because there's so much more new stuff.
Yeah, yeah, that's fair.
You know, with the monoculture disappearing and whatnot.
Yes. And did you see the $1,000 Blu-ray for this?
Oh, it's in a humidor, right?
Yeah, in a cigar humidor.
So good. Yeah. One of the, again, that 20th anniversary thing, one of the things came with like a gold money clip, like one of the levels that you can purchase it at. It was so funny. Just such hilarious opulence for a film release.
Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah. Speaking of opulence, the production design of this movie is awesome.
Yeah, I don't even know how to tackle the look of this movie. Oh, I mean, we talked a bit about it, but
there's like one of my favorite touches is the elevator in Robert Loggia's home that we get Michelle Pfeiffer's introduction to, how she takes the elevator down one floor and then has to go down like five steps. Like there's no, like even if a physically handicapped person was in Robert Loggia's home, they would still have to carry him up the five steps to get him upstairs, you know? That's a level of hilarious. Like I laughed out loud so hard when I saw her going down those five steps. Like it was already stupid. And then that's just like the really great punchline.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of just, I mean, that's a really big example, but there's just such expensive things all throughout this movie. And to, again, Brian De Palma's credit, I think he uses wide-angle shots really well in this movie in that, you know, it's shot anamorphic, the 2.35:1 aspect ratio, and you just get to see a lot of the scenery, which I think in De Palma's style, like this, that's sort of a choice for this movie. Like he does use a lot of wide shots typically, but not ones that are meant to show us the set so much. And I thought that was a good choice, you know, in this movie.
And am I right in thinking that that happens somewhat gradually? I mean, it's not as though everything at the beginning is super tight and then by the end it's all wide, but It seems as kind of his empire gets bigger and his world gets bigger, the frame opens up a bit more. I mean, you discussed that interrogation scene as being kind of small and claustrophobic. And then, I don't know. I felt it kind of it leaned on some of the bigger, more expansive stuff as the story went on.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I mean, certainly the property that he owns gets bigger, and so it allows you to do more. And I hadn't thought about that, but I think you are right. And even when they are in these bigger spaces and there are these wider shots, there's still the claustrophobic feeling of people. Like in Freedom Town, is that what it was called? Where they're living for the first month or so of the movie. That you get a really big wide shot of them walking through the crowd to Manny walking to the basketball hoop where they're playing some game basketball-esque.
If only he hit that three at the end.
Oh, it would have been so good.
I just want that reaction shot so badly.
It would have been like Sigourney Weaver in Alien 4. That's like, a, you know, it's a big wide shot. It takes its time, but it is And it does exist in this very big area, but it is claustrophobic because of how many people are shoved into that area, you know? And yeah. You get some similar versions of that on the beaches of Miami. You know, you get this big wide crane shot, but they're still occupying a very small amount of space in this big pool. Yeah. You know?
That's where I learned girls like ice cream. Yeah, I was also thinking about there's that long zoom out when he's looking at the world's yours blimp through the glass.
Yeah.
That's a pretty big
a good point.
They start that pretty tight, but by the end of that it's obviously evinced by the phrase the world is yours, but it's about the world getting bigger and kind of more things becoming under your purview.
Yeah, absolutely.
And another thing I noticed about the progression of this is, you know, we talked a bit earlier about the pinks and the whites and a lot of the bright colors. But as we watch him go through, you know, the bigger properties, it just gets a lot darker. There's a lot more blacks. He starts dressing in black a lot more.
Yeah, for sure.
Black and gold. It's kind of just this dark, evil empire expanding. And lots of hot pinks and whites and yellows and zebra stripes and wonderful 80s decor near the beginning. But that kind of fades as time goes on and it's just less light. I mean, it's just not lit as clearly. It's just darker and more of the movie takes place at night at the end of the, it's just the general theme of things getting darker for him.
Yeah, exactly. And especially his office at the end, it really feels like a coffin, you know, like, cause it is so dark and everything seems to be velvet. But yeah, I agree entirely, especially about that stuff towards the end of the movie. One other production design thing that I just feel it's almost elevator-esque to me is the his hot tub in the middle of a carpeted room. So good. I loved it so much. And, obviously I had known that scene existed, but like that whole room, I mean, I guess if you have a hot tub in the middle of your room, you've got to build the room around it, but the whole room seems built around the hot tub. And I think
it's so
unnecessarily large. And I think the cherry on top of the wonderful sundae is that he's already in his ashtray, which you can see towards the end of the scene, there's already a cigar that has been finished. So he's been in that bathtub for almost two full cigar lengths, which is awesome.
Yeah, watching a TV that is 0.05% the size of his hot tub.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the height of luxury.
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah, it's just a weird, like his best friend and his wife are there while he's in the hot tub watching TV smoking cigars.
It really is weird.
It's an odd life he's chosen.
I mean, there's so many bizarre moments in this movie, and I think we've kind of talked about it without really talking about it. Like, it oscillates between being a really cool movie and a really accidentally funny movie and a really good action movie sometimes. And I don't know, there's just so many things happen in this movie. It really does. Again, I don't know what being on coke feels like, but I would imagine it feels like watching this movie.
I think there's a reason for that.
Yeah, exactly. Although Oliver Stone says he couldn't write while he was on cocaine.
Yeah, he had to go to Paris where cocaine doesn't exist.
Apparently. I don't know. I don't know much about the French people. But
who knows?
Apparently I know one thing. There's no cocaine.
Yeah.
According to noted factologist Oliver Stone.
Cocaine factologist.
Yeah. You know what? That's true. That's true. I'll give you that.
There's a lot of things I don't trust his opinion on, but cocaine, I will take his word.
Yeah, for sure.
A legitimately, I thought, good, I guess, visual element or little sequence is when he's at the Babylon Club with Mel, our favorite corrupt drug cop.
Yes.
And, you know, they're sitting around that table and he's looking for a bribe, and you kind of get the feeling that he's done this with many people before. And then Tony's wondering how many more times am I going to have to do this for you or for other people? And then that sense of paranoia is setting in, and just this idea of the world getting out of control and, you know, too many people to keep a thumb on and all this. And we're just surrounded by mirrors and we're seeing essentially two people, but we're seeing, you know, 20 different heads at any given time. Mm-hmm. And I really like the sense of paranoia that gives you, and I thought that was just a good sequence.
Yeah, especially since it really feels like my recollection of that shot that you're talking about, I think there are just more Harris Yulins in that shot than there are Al Pacinos. Like the mirrors on him seem to outnumber Tony, and I think that's a cool element as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so in that sequence, he's
drinking a glass of milk, yes.
Drinking a glass of milk, obviously. No, he's keeping a close eye on Gina, his sister there. What did you think of the whole Gina subplot of this?
So weird. I don't know. I will say I love the Tony Montana rage theme whenever he sees his it happens two times. It happens the first time he sees his sister in the club, and then we just get the zoom in on Tony's eyes and cutting to Gina, and there's just these pulsing synths of rage. I love that. It happens then, and it happens right when he kills Manolo, but it's also weird to me, you know?
Yeah.
I just don't. All matters involving women in this movie, I will abstain. I just don't have a take on it. It's very bizarre.
You don't even want to chime in on how Artie slaps her in the bathroom?
No.
It's so unpleasant. Like, yeah. Obviously, anytime a woman gets hit like that in a movie, it's very unpleasant.
Yeah, of course.
She drops so hard.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing is, like, they, with their relationship in this movie, it's like, she loves him so much when she sees him again. And then it seems like the next time they see each other is at the club. And like the second she sees him, she's furious at him. You know, like it's, I don't know. It's weird. In fairness, he did break into a bathroom and that's where they meet each other. But, that's where she realizes he's there. But still, it's just, I don't know. I feel like there was a missing scene in the middle there.
Yeah, this move should be longer, right?
Yeah, definitely. That's what it needs.
Yeah. Well, I just, it's weird because, I mean, it's so just the notion of incest as is kind of implied throughout the movie and then said, you know, very specifically by her, mm-hmm. You know, is obviously unsettling and weird. I'm just having a hard time kind of tracking his, I don't know, his moral descent, I guess. Or is that one of the things that doesn't even exist in this movie is that he's kind of a bad guy and always has been a bad guy?
I mean, he's definitely a bad guy and always has been.
Can I pause this for 1 second?
Yeah, for sure.
Sorry.
Well, he's definitely a bad guy, and I think moral descent isn't really something that happens in this movie or exists in this movie, at least from Tony's perspective. But I kind of think the idea that we're supposed to feel, especially when he kills Manolo at the end and from that point on, is that it's kind of a coke-fueled rampage, and that he doesn't really kill Manny so much as the coke killed his common sense, and then he killed Manny.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense, because that seems like the point, you know, is as soon as it gets to your best friend and your family. Mm-hmm. You know, he's come, he's met these new people, he's terrible towards them, but they're kind of these faceless people that are just in his way. Mm-hmm. But it seems as though, you know, he's known his sister since she was very young, and he and Manny seem very close and to have a close relationship, so it seems like it crossed a line when he started doing terrible things to the people he cares about. Mm-hmm. And again, the kind of question of incest comes in there because, you know, why is he that upset that Manny has married his sister, you know? Yeah.
Well, he doesn't know they're married.
That's true, I guess. But
still, it's still insane, but
yeah, no. I know what you mean, but that's a good point. I'm just having some trouble thinking about, you know, this trajectory for him, because the other scene that I always forget about and no one ever talks about is when he refuses to kill the woman and children of the person who's about to make the speech.
Yeah.
And that seems to be the only time, you know, we see anything like a soft side of his. You know, up until then, it seemed maybe, oh, he loves his sister and he's protective of her. For, you know, perhaps altruistic reasons. He wants to protect her from the kind of people, you know, like him. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the kind of people who would maybe not be, let's just say, a classiest person, the way he treats her and takes her into a bathroom. And so, you know, it seems like, oh, he was a good guy and then he turned bad because of his greed. And, you know, that seems to be the way that a lot of these movies go.
Yeah.
But then we have him being, you know, an asshole since we meet him. And yeah. then near the end of this movie, one kind of glimmer of decency, not wanting to kill children. Mm-hmm. And then him kind of going back to being a terrible person again.
Yeah, I think it can still, because again, he does a humorous amount of cocaine in that car sequence as well. So it's, you can't say that the coke is fully taken over, but like, I don't know, I can sort of see how he would stand up for those kids that are right in front of his face, that he has time to sort of sit and think about, even in a coked up mind state, think about the fact that he is killing two kids that are literally playing patty cake in front of him.
And yeah, he does follow them. Yeah, it's a good point. There is more of that time factor in there.
Yeah, exactly. And he still kind of acts insanely in that sequence when he shoots the guy. Like, he could have just, like, hit the brakes, you know? Like, there are ways to get out of that situation that involve or that don't involve shooting Mark Margolis in the head, you know? Yeah, he still kind of acts insanely. As far as the Manolo thing, I think, again, that's a coke-fueled rampage. And the movie doesn't give us a POV shot to show his, like, shaky eyes or whatever, to show that he is in a drugged-up mind state, which I think is a smart decision. It just shows us a lot of examples of him doing so much cocaine. Like, he dumps that thing out on the table before he shoots Manolo, and it's this very huge amount, and he makes this giant line just with his hand, like he's drawing a line in the sand. And then he gets out multiple bags of cocaine after he's killed Manolo. I think my theory on this movie and the ending of this movie is that he kills Manolo and then goes into his cave and kills himself, and everything that happens once he gets back to the mansion is pretty much him having a coke-fueled fantasy of how he wants the end of his life to go, because that's the only way that explains how many times he gets shot,
right?
And he's like, he's dealing with his issues with his sister, whatever they may be, at the beginning, which is pretty crazy in its own right. And then also he has this last stand of just, I get to go out. If I'm going out, I want this to look or be how it looks like when I go out, even though he's just like, no, I just killed my best friend. I'm coked out of my mind. I'm very depressed, you know?
Yeah. And maybe it's not even, did you say he would have killed himself? And that's,
I think that's kind of when I watched this movie again, I was sort of thinking like, that feels more like what the ending of this movie is supposed to be, you know, because it is such it's a movie, like the ending is just so intense and so like they ratchet it up so quickly that it kind of feels a bit removed from the movie in the way that sort of dream sequences often do. And yeah. there's no line, you know, it's not like, you know, it's almost like a Mulholland Drive dream sequence where is it a dream sequence? I don't know. But yeah, it does feel removed from the movie in a way that I think, I don't think my theory is insane, you know?
Yeah, no, it's, and I can't even believe I'm saying this, but up until the end, this movie is at least realistic.
Yes.
You know, for a movie that is so excessive in the way that the story is told and the way that it's filmed and the music and all that, people get shot in the chest and then they fall down dead in the first action sequence. Mm-hmm. You know, these aren't huge gun battles where Tony gets shot 50 times. I mean, Manny gets shot and survives it, but a bullet through the arm is crazy. Yeah, we don't see these superhuman feats anywhere. And we have, Gina acting, you know, we'll say oddly. Now, she did just witness a murder of her husband.
All of her actions can be justified by the fact that they also gave her some drugs and her husband was just murdered.
And she's been abused by Tony for a long time, it seems. So that's not crazy, but you can also see that fitting in with your theory. And I think that does make a lot of sense. I mean, she's acting so oddly. I mean, when that second wave of Colombians comes in, you know, just 60 more people show up. The idea of him even accidentally killing himself, you know, just having a cocaine-fueled heart attack.
Yeah.
And as he's going out, this is kind of just what flashes through his brain, I think makes a lot of sense because, you know, losing a gunfight isn't cool, but if you're going to do it, you might as well take out all these people with you and fall into a pool that says the world is yours if you're going
to
go out.
Yeah, exactly. And get shot about like 5 to 8 times without showing any ill effects other than the bullet entering your body. You're just like, it's fine, I'm Tony, you know?
In your chest, and it just hulks you up instead of taking you down at all. Yeah. No, sure. I'm going to buy that theory.
Okay, cool. Thanks, man. So I'm curious to know your take on this, because there are multiple instances in Al Pacino's career with Brian De Palma even, where he plays somebody of a different ethnicity, and nobody cares. And especially like Scarface, there are so many Cuban people being played by non-Cuban people. And
there's only one Cuban person.
Sorry?
I think one Cuban actor.
Yes, Stephen Bauer is Cuban, or at least of Cuban descent. And like even now, it doesn't seem like anybody has ever talked about the fact that Al Pacino, playing this iconic character, is playing somebody in a different ethnicity than he actually is. And in Carlito's Way, he's playing a Puerto Rican, which is the other movie he made with Brian De Palma, which has some cool stuff. And Viggo Mortensen is also playing a Puerto Rican, classic Puerto Rican named Viggo Mortensen.
Fun.
And I'm just curious to know your take on it. Is this just like an ethnicity that culture hasn't decided that we care about yet? Or is it Al Pacino a big enough star that it doesn't matter?
I'm going to say it's at least 3 different things.
Is this like the Robert Downey Jr. in Tropic Thunder thing?
Nothing's like that.
Okay. it's certainly not like that. I concur.
That was way too late. But anyway, it's okay. So it's at least 3 things, and with one kind of footnote off the hop. Some people did care.
Okay.
There were Cuban groups and Cuban people.
Oh, certainly that cared about the way that Cubans were portrayed in the movie, but not that Cubans were portrayed by non-Cubans, I don't think, right?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I think even that line's kind of blurry.
Okay.
I think that it was a time where people didn't really care that much about the Cuban people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a bad time for Cuban-American relationships in a admittedly rocky history.
Mm-hmm.
Between the two nations. But I think that's part of it. And I think within America, there was, you know, this movie said that 25,000 of those people came with criminal records. Mm-hmm. I'm always at least a little skeptical of those stats and those charges coming from a nation like Cuba in the state that it was at the time. But I think there's just a lot of anti-Cuban sentiment at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's also a spectrum of races.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think, I think if he was doing blackface, it would be different than from him playing someone that I think on that spectrum is considered not too far from Al Pacino.
Okay. That's fair.
Yeah, I mean, he worked with a dialect coach and to try to get some of the language and the voice and the mannerisms down. Yeah, I do think it's weird. I think it's, it's a performance people just liked, you know?
Yeah, no, 100%.
That's also just part of it. I think all those other factors play into it, but yeah, I mean, he'd done Puerto Rican and, I think it's, you know, all those factors, kind of cultural, historical, combined with we're also overlooking people that may have cared, but no one wanted to listen to or talk about.
Yeah, that's fair. And I kind of have the same feeling as you did. I was just curious to know if you felt that way, just because I always find these things kind of interesting. Like, I don't know, I feel like there's a weird sliding scale of racism that seems to change by the day. And I'm always trying to figure it out, and this is just an example where I thought your thoughts would be interesting. So.
Yeah, sorry to let you down.
No, it's fine. No, they were. It's just I don't know. I agree with what you're saying as far as like the spectrum of ethnicities and stuff like that. There are it is like I said, like a sliding scale, and this is just not a scale the scale that people care about, I guess. You know?
Yeah, and I mean
the plight of the Cuban actor is not something we're fighting for.
Yeah, but I always say that, even like I just did with Tropic Thunder, where I think we're past something, and then something happens. But I mean, people do get outraged, but it's still think things like that still often surprise me. So that's why I sound like I can't fully explain the Scarface one, but that seems to be the factors at work in my opinion.
That's fair.
Did you notice that typing in "say hello to my little friend" on Wikipedia immediately directs you to the Scarface page?
I did not. That's great.
Without even a disambiguation page.
That's really great.
I just love the idea of someone trying to search a movie by the quote they remember.
Yeah, for sure. It's a real, like, mom and dad having a conversation at the dinner table and can't figure out which movie they're talking about. But just going back to the things that of how entrenched in culture Scarface sort of was, like I "say hello to your little friend" my little friend is another example of that, is that the, like, I just remember when Grand Theft Auto Vice City came out and it was just basically like Scarface the game with a little bit of Miami Vice thrown in. And then even all the promo materials for that game featured the song from the montage in Scarface, and it was just so like not even thinly veiled, you know, just like, this is, we're gonna make a Scarface video game, isn't that cool? You know, we don't have the licensing, but we've got the cool game. So
Scarface video game. It's right there, and I think it's just
to the limit was the name of the song.
I think even on the soundtrack of the game there's, I guarantee, two, possibly three Scarface soundtrack. Like, and those were in Scarface because they were very kind of emblematic, popular 80s songs.
Yeah.
You know,
In the 80s, everybody was Rush into the AO.
Of course. It was right on. I mean, there's the club in that game is designed just like the Babylon Club, and there's a secret bathroom that has a shower that's all bloody that looks just like the one Angel gets chainsawed in. I mean, it was very on the nose.
I didn't play a lot of the game. Can you get a tiger in it?
I don't think so. That tiger hates his life in this movie. He's chained up.
It's terrible. I mean, I've told you this, but I was in Louisiana last fall, and LSU's campus just has a giant tiger cage with a tiger that lives there year round. And eventually, like when I heard that idea, I was like, "Oh, it sounds terrible." But it turns out he has a bigger cage than he probably would have had at a zoo. But there's also somebody with just a gas station in Baton Rouge that has a tiger in a cage out front of his gas station all year, which is fucking crazy. And doesn't seem like the way that Scarface would have expanded his interests into gas stations, but I guess anything's possible.
Did you see that Saddam Hussein, one of his money laundering businesses called Montana Management?
I did, and I felt bad about how hard I laughed at it.
Yeah, I know.
I felt a little guilty.
Yeah. Well, and one other kind of cultural thing too is that this movie, I mean, you were saying how it was, you know, some of the rappers in the early 90s that really took to it in the biggest way. This movie comes out at kind of the rise of hip hop.
Yeah, 100%.
And that's something when I think of Scarface and hip hop, I think of a lot of the things that we discussed, but it was coming up on the 80s decade of hip hop popularity, as I said, but of the greed and cocaine use that will come to define the era that, you know, kind of goes hand in hand with early hip hop as well. And I forgot about how well those things time out. I mean, 1983 isn't the year of gangster rap by any means, but the continuum's right there.
Yeah, and how many of those rappers built their career, again, I specifically mentioned Jay-Z and Biggie, they built their careers on their images of drug dealing. And so naturally Scarface is a logical idol, you know, and a logical figurehead for them to see themselves as. I mean, you see this a lot in gangster movies of any sort. Again, with Biggie, he idolized Frank White from King of New York as well. And so, you know, it's part of it is just that, like, anything involving drug dealing, drug dealers are gonna like, you know, and people that are also aspiring to other things, aspiring to build their businesses. And I think that is a theme through Scarface that we haven't really talked about, that whole ruthlessness that it takes to sort of build a very high level business. I think is one of the more interesting things that runs through the movie, and it's kind of gets its ending in the bad guy scene. But I don't know. I just enjoy that whole, like, the determination he has, and the fact that he sort of has to be thinking about it all the time. Like, in the shower sequence, after the shower sequence, when he's running out to the street to kill the guy, he says, "Chi-Chi, get the yayo." Like, even after he saw his friend's head cut in half with a chainsaw, he's still thinking, this is a smart business move if we bring this cocaine with you. And it's just, I think that really shows how ruthless you have to be in order to be a really successful business person. And I think Scarface shows why you should stop at a certain point. I think it's kind of, it's not a totally anti-capitalist movie, but I think it's interesting that the movie sort of says that capitalism should have its limits. And I enjoy that about it. Because if you go too far, you turn into coked out nightmare Tony Montana.
It begins with being compared to a capitalist society as well, or communist society as well.
Yeah, exactly. So I like that part of the movie that runs throughout it, you know. And I think one thing I really like about the bad guy scene, I mean, I like everything about it, the way it's shot in one take.
Such a bummer.
It's a bummer, but like,
it's trying to be, but just this, we get a few where it's hard to feel bad for Tony, but when in that scene, everyone's just so quiet and burnt out and slumped over and hating their life and saying awful shit about each other in public and an uncomfortable social situation. It's unpleasant.
Yeah, and if we look at the production design of that scene, which we've been talking about more in this movie than we do in most of our podcasts, but like, it's a very old world looking restaurant, and they seem to be the only new money people in there. I mean, I guess we don't know anything about Elvira's background, but she doesn't seem like, judging by, you know, I assume if I were to ask Oliver Stone what her background was like, I don't think she came from money. But like, they're in sort of this representation of the old world, and they're surrounded by older people that have had their money for a long time, and we get this really great monologue from Pacino told in the long take. He's stumbling around because he's drunk, and it's a really great performance by him. But the crux of the speech is about how there's not that much difference between Tony Montana and the other people in the restaurant. And the fact that the other people have this symbol to point to, this drug dealer to point to, as somebody that is worse than them. You know, I mean, Tony Montana is a murderer, so that's a pretty high offense on the level of human, I don't know, human offenses. And the fact that he exists allows them to not focus on the shitty things that they have done to get their money. And and I think that's a cool scene that is done really well, and fits in with the really good filmmaking portion of this movie, which is at least a third, I would say.
It's sprinkled throughout.
Yeah, exactly. This movie's like weirdly like it feels like a mini series that is all, it's got a really good showrunner, but goes really up and down and with some of the directors they choose for some episodes, you know?
And part of that, as you were saying, these people feeling better than Tony, is that we see him achieve what he achieves partially through legitimate means and money laundering and going through these banks. And, you know, the first thing he did, killing that Cuban official, it got him his green card. I mean, someone in the American government is tied up in this deal. You know what I mean? Yeah, this wasn't just purely bad actors, you know, in a moral sense. There are people who are involved in what we think of as the good side of law and order to get him to where he was in the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
Good.
Okay, so thank you for listening to The MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check back next week when we'll be talking about something else.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.